Hello, I'm Dr. David Johnson, professor of medicine and chief of gastroenterology at Eastern Virginia Medical School in Norfolk, Virginia. Well, in July, the U.S. Multi-Society Task Force of GI Societies published their newest guideline on the recommendation for colon cancer screening. And this reflects an update from the 2008 guideline and certainly time based on evidence and new disease state understandings. But let me give you some snapshots of what's new about this and what do you need to know as a clinician. Well, first is that there was a unique approach to this, which was thought to be, again, more facile for clinicians to apply. And the idea was to look at the way that people are screened. One is a programmatic screening, and this is basically done by large health systems. Kaiser is a great example here, which they uniformly roll this out. They've got the systems to ensure that these patients are notified, that there's adequacy of the follow-up of these patients if they don't comply, or if there's a positive, they are generated into a logical sequential test, in particular colonoscopy. But programmatic testing is not what most of us do in our day-to-day practice. The opportunistic testing is when the patients come in and the care provider and the patient have a dialogue about, hey, it's time for colon cancer screening. Well, there were three different kind of tiers of way that this could be approached. One was the giving the idea of multiple options, and this is in the context of patients like to have choices. So the option of a colonoscopy or a FIT test, those would be options. And if they said no to that, they would be offered some other tier of options. And I'll go through the tiers in a second. But the idea of giving 9 different tests that are available for colorectal screening and present commercially available, we sometimes confuse the patient, and really some very seminal work by John Anadomi and his group at the University of Washington University in Washington State basically looked at the idea of offering too many options as confusing to the patients. So generally 2 to 3 is kind of the sweet spot as far as it looks at what would patients really respond to. So I'll give you this option. If you say no, then we give you a second option and perhaps a third option, but don't get too confusing on that. The second of the multiple options now is the sequential approach. And this says the patient, well, you would prefer this. I'm your gastroenterologist. I would recommend this, a colonoscopy. Or if you say no to that, then I'll come and default against what else would be available in the next test. So the multiple options giving the patient the choice, or sequential options giving you, here's my prioritization. If you don't take this, how about this? And these are the sequential and prioritization. And the third is really the risk stratified approach. And this basically says, you know, these are great tests, and this is a test that we could offer as a tier one test, perhaps. But because of your pivotal risks that we recognize as greater, be it male age, smoking history is incredibly powerful. Family history obviously has some influence. It's a separate risk. But the average risk we talk about, smoking, obesity, diabetes has crept into this a bit, and maybe that's a patient that you would say in a risk stratified that this is where I really want you to go. So the task force concluded that none of these have been tested, but it's nice to have options. So programmatic screening or the opportunistic screening with the multiple options, looking at the sequential approach or the risk stratified approach. We don't really have evidence, but they seem reasonable as it relates to discussion with your patients. Well, the next area that came into the kind of the threshold of discussion was the specific screening tests. And the task force analyzed all the data, colonoscopy first, and recognizing some of the downsides of colonoscopy were some of the complications related to this, both on the GI and the non-GI side, but again, relatively rare in expert hands, and particularly in screening tests. One thing that was emphasized by the task force was the use of cold snare in this technology of colonoscopy and how this becomes a very, very safe and effective, almost no delayed bleeding risk, and something that I do in patients on antiplatelet therapy or anticoagulants and do routinely. So a sonometer, less than a sonometer, typically sessile lesions, non-pedunculated. This became a very strong recommendation, not official recommendation, but the dialogue of cold snare is part of colonoscopy and the screening in response to what we can achieve. The idea of quality in the colonoscopy also became a real issue, and recognizing the operator dependence on this, not so clear that it's just gastroenterology versus the world, but it's really the specifics of who performs this and are they held accountable to quality. And this is where I would put in a huge plea that you need to be accounting for your quality metrics, adenoma detection rate, cecal intubation, your compliance with surveillance intervals. These are things that really resonate with particularly insurance companies, but also build your operator experience as far as the expert in looking at how you perform. The task force went as far as to generate tools for to enhance colonoscopy quality, three of which were intended for patients to ask us the questions. One was, what's your adenoma detection rate? And we know that the adenoma detection rate, blended rate, 25% or greater, 30% for males, 20% for females. But again, if you're not reporting this and not recording it in a way that you can show this, you're potentially subject to some risk. And I really plea, if you're not involved in gastrointestinal quality insurance, the quality consortium, GI Quick, you need to be, and you really need to look at this. This is registered now with CMS as an approved database and meets all the metrics for a variety of reporting and some of the quality metrics as we look forward to penalties that you can have in the next several years. So for the tools for the patient to ask you, ADR, what's your cecal intubation rate? Should be 95% or greater in screening and 90% overall. And then what do you do in your preps? You do split dosing. And that's, again, when we had the multi-sided task force on preps, we said that was the standard of care. The exception is same-day prep, then it's fine. But again, that's very rare in most of our practices. And then there were two tools that the endoscopy report should include. And this is really important to make sure that you photo document. I'm aware of some insurance companies right now that don't pay unless you have photo documentation. I'm fine with that. But it is something that you should document in your report that you had photo documentation, cecum, appendiceal orifice, terminal ileum, what have you, it should be in your report. And then adequacy of the bowel prep is part of your report. So quality reporting gets into this document as well as setting new standards as far as our quality for colonoscopy. The second was fit testing. There, I refer you to the multi-sided task force that was led in their publication last year in 2016 by Doug Robertson, a superb overview of fit testing, and this is something that you can look at. Again, recognizing that fit is very much replaced fecal occult blood testing. The downside of fit is the detection of serrated lesions, and this is really not a good test for generally for adenomatous polyps, advanced adenomas, but very poor for serrated lesions. Enter into the next test, which is the fecal DNA test, which incorporates FIT with the fecal DNA testing and is superior as it relates to the serrated lesions in, as it relates to FIT and advanced adenomas, particularly because of the incorporation of a hypermethylation pathway assessment, which is what most serrated lesion involves. So the fecal DNA has this FIT plus the DNA testing, and it's basically picking up more serrated lesions that the FIT misses. The downside of it is incredibly expensive. It's $600 commercial, $500 plus for Medicare. Again, recognition of cost and whether or not the juice is worth the squeeze. Again, patients like it because they don't have to fool with stool. It's a little compliance of they drop something in the potty insert, they mail this, and FedEx comes and picks them up. But however, CT colonography got, an acknowledgement that this is something frequently, certainly as an alternative, and replace barium enema in the previous guidelines, but basically it's really got very limited application. If you look at the U.S., still requires a prep, at least in most of the studies, and particularly in the U.S., the radiation exposure is an issue. Even the radiologists prefer CT colonoscopy as a second choice to colonoscopy in a recent paper that was published in their journal. Flexible sigmoidoscopy got a bit of a twist here. It's recognized that it's a great colon cancer screening test, and certainly the recommendation was every 5 years. The task force recognized there was very little data on that and recognized, although it's very rarely used in this country because particularly of the sedation effect, the lack of sedation, the task force suggested that the primary recommendation could be every 10 years or five. So again, latitude to choose. but the first choice was 10 years based on what we could see in the data. The next was capsule colonoscopy. The data is emerging on this. Again, approved by the FDA in particular for failed completion of colonoscopy, not yet covered for screening. So again, compliance issue with insurance, again, lowers the likelihood that this will get paid for. So it was not a high recommendation, but recognize the data is emerging on this. More trials pending, but the data looks quite good so far. Septin 9, again, was a blood serum blood testing, which was looking at another avenue where serologic testing might fit in very nice. And a study that looked at this with compliance with colon cancer screening, patients that refuse colonoscopy actually would accept the SEP9 assay. Epigenomics makes this. It's commercially available. When the task force looked at this and looked at specific trial of screening in the prospective trial of screening, it didn't meet what they felt to be enough to incorporate that in the guideline as a formal recommendation. So what did they suggest? Well, they broke it out based on tiers of recommendations. So tier one is colonoscopy, which is an average risk done every 10 years, the FIT test annually, and then the second tier, which is CT colonography every 5 years, the fecal DNA test every 3 years, and flexible sigmoidoscopy every 10 years to 5 years, if you'd so prefer. Tier three was capsule colonoscopy, again, difficult for insurance reasons, and not recommended, at least at present, was the SEP9 testing. The next question that comes up very frequently in my practice in particular is special populations. What about family history? And what about other special recognitions? Well, the task force at this point, first of all, said African Americans should agreeably now between all three of the GI societies that it should begin at 45. So we recognize African Americans have earlier onset and more aggressive disease. Begin at 45 in African Americans and then follow them at that point as whatever your findings were for an average risk if there were no polyps or neoplastic polyps and otherwise directed by polyp surveillance guidelines. So African Americans, 45, new recommendation uniformly now from the multi-society task force, previously recommended by the American College and also the American Society of Gastrointestinal Endoscopy. Next is family history. No real change here as it relates to the patients. The discriminant age seems to be 60. So over the age of 60 or greater, they would be followed in particular at a decade shift. So the recommendation is begin at 40 rather than 50, but then follow as an average risk. So decade shift if they're 60 or greater. Again, if they're not, then they get decade shifted up to 40 and they're followed as an average risk thereafter. Two first-degree relatives of any age, they get, again, surveyed at or screened at an age 10 years before the earliest cancer, and they then get followed at five-year intervals. About advanced adenomas, again, the task force wrestled with this because really it's not often that our patients come in with a histology report from one of their relatives. If you had something that was obvious, like they had a surgery because of that, you'd imply advanced adenoma. If there was something that we could put more concrete data around, again, advanced adenomas would be followed as a colon cancer in a first-degree relative. So those would be, again, decade shifted or at that point at five-year intervals and followed up with basically after the initial exam. The next area that really comes up all the time is beginning to recognize that age is a variable. Not only age on a older person, when do we stop, but when do we start? There's a growing recognition that although we're doing very well with a reduction of almost 3% a year over the last decade of colon cancer incidents, we're seeing an increase in patients that are younger. So in their 20s and 30s and 40s, we're seeing an increase in colon cancer, in particular rectal cancer, higher risk. But what do we do with those patients? Well, the task force looked at the data and basically said that there is something that is clearly a signal there, not enough to change uniformly the threshold amount for age at 50 or 45 for African Americans. But don't dismiss, in particular, the key point here is pivotal signs or symptoms of bleeding. So signs of bleeding or overt bleeding, evidence of bleeding with the particular iron deficiency or unexplained melena, really not a symptom of bleeding other than stool frequency or something that would be a malodorous stool. It sounds like melena. But again, in the younger patient, bleeding is the index threshold to aggressively pursue with colonoscopy. The other symptoms that we see, patients tell you, change in bowel habits, constipation, change in the caliber of the stool. When these have been looked at, they haven't been incrementally beneficial as far as detection of cancer. So the threshold symptom or sign is bleeding in those patients under the age of 50 or 45 in the African-American population. The next pivotal question is, when do we stop? So you have some patients that say, how much longer do I need to do this? And then you got these other people who say, you know, you're getting kind of old. And they say, don't give up on me. What else do you know about me? Well, the U.S. Preventive Task Force came out at an age of 75 and said that's the threshold where it starts to get into the murky areas, grade C evidence. 80 starts to get into grade C to D, and 85 absolute do not do screening exams. So the task force suggested that the incremental risk of cancer is evident up to the age of 85, and if somebody's never had a cancer detection or cancer screening test, you should consider screening those people. Again, how is up to you and relative to their overall risk, but that's where screening at least should be considered. We're talking about screening now, not surveillance. It's a whole different topic, and that has to be risk adjusted based on the individual. But in the patients that have never been screened, that would be at least a discussion of perhaps consider something, colonoscopy being what other risks are. The when to stop comes down to what their other comorbidities and life expectancy is, and really basically shows the comorbidities being a life expectancy less than 10 years, and that becomes a dialogue with the patient. This is really not necessarily about screening you anymore. We're happy to respond to signs or symptoms, but again, it doesn't really reflect appropriate screening, and we really have to start to draw that in, and it doesn't mean that we're giving up on you, but it means that we give you a hall pass here, because some of these patients may have incident cancers that may not be causal as it relates to signs or symptoms that cause them harm. So the task force really did a great job in giving us some guidelines that really I think are clinically reflective. The highlights in particular, looking at the bifurcated way of a programmatic and opportunistic screening, look at the tiered approaches as we look at the tier 1, 2, and 3, and looking at ways that we can operationalize those, in particular looking at ages, looking at the age and it relates to when to start, when to stop. Don't forget the discriminant of bleeding in the patients that are under 50 or 45 in the screening population. They should have colonoscopy. Short of that, they should be evaluated perhaps, but not necessarily with colonoscopy. That's where the bang for the buck comes. And then we look at the age to stop as we start to look at comorbidities, 10-year life expectancy, have these conversations with the patients. Many will go, huh, I get a hall pass. Others will say, really? Can I do this one more time? And again, these are things that are meant to be risk adjusted and always do the best for your patient. Conversations you have to put in perspective for them. So the task force has given us new guidance. Pay attention to these, look at these, and again, apply these in your practice. Refer to the quality issues that I alluded to as it relates to patient questions. You need to be thinking about that. Patient questions and then the documentation in your endo report. So patient questions, adenoma detection rate, do you do how do you do your prep? Is it a split prep? And again, what's your cecal intubation rate? We should know these, but the way to know these is also to document that. Again, if you're not doing GI Quick, you should be. Again, some national registry database is incredibly more and more important, both for quality reporting, for financial advantage from the standpoint, and again, really, it's the right thing to do. I'm Dr. David Johnson. Thanks again for listening. We'll talk to you soon.